Hello and welcome to Arena on Culture Night, coming to you live this evening from the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray. Oh, yes. The Bray folk are happy to be out tonight, as are we on Culture Night. Really a fantastic autumn highlight for all of us on the Arena team. Last year, we travelled north and west to Manor Hamilton in County Leitrim. This year, we travelled south along the coastline to the seaside town of Bray and the Mermaid Arts Centre. What a show we have in store for you this evening. Junior Brother is here, Susan O'Neill is here, as is filmmaker Alan Gilsonen and visual artist Harold Ofe. But to start this evening, he travelled north and east. John Spillane, Cork legend, Fir Uisce, the legend of the Loch, is a two-hour Gaelic folk opera which John himself describes as his magnus opus, drawing on his lifelong dedication to storytelling, the Irish language and music. Here he is telling us how it all starts.
August so in some tear for heen. So in a scan a go, she skillonimo. Sugar lum she og in some tear for heen. Tear no nog, August tear no nozzle. Tear no nog, in some tear for heen. Tear no nog, August tear no nishel. Tear no nog, in some tear for heen.
There you go, John Spillane with the Réibhéol, or the overture to his new folk opera, Fir Uisce, The Legend of the Loch, which is in fact currently exists as an album, but I cannot wait for it to exist as a stage show. John, you're all about storytelling. You always have been. You use all sorts of tools to tell stories. There you did it with your guitar and such atmosphere that you created with the voice and the music. What story are you telling about this loch of ancient laughter and loch of legend?
Well, it's a loch we have down in Cork. I don't know if you're familiar with it, people of Bray.
Oh, people know Cork, yeah.
It's in the suburbs of Cork there, about a mile from the city centre, the Loch, it's called. It goes very unsung, but what it has is a beautiful folk tale which was published in 1828 in a book called Fairy Legends and Traditions of the South of Ireland by Thomas Crofton Croker, and it tells of the beautiful green valley that was there and the well which overflowed. Now, I turned it into a Gaelic folk opera, but this opera, it came out last Sunday. It comes with a warning, Sean Rocks. It's over 2 hours long. It's 88% in Irish, and it's absolutely brilliant.
And I can attest to that, because on this very programme last week, the album received 5 stars.
5 out of 5 in Arena, lads. Where would you get
reviews?
Thank you, Sean Ross. What a laugh.
And that was the two reviewers. I was the arbiter of it all. I had no personal involvement in those figures. But it is interesting you say about the bilingual nature of it, John. How important is that? Because, Thomas, what did you say your man's name who wrote the story was Thomas?
Thomas Crofton Croker.
I'm guessing he wouldn't have had Alain Gaeilge.
So he would have been from the, like, what we call the ascendancy, Protestant ascendancy, from the big house. But he was a very famous man in his time. And the story that he wrote about Erlach, it was translated the following year into German by their brothers Grimm, Springwasser, they called it. And they had it in another famous book called Elfenmärchen, of Irish fairy tales. But what I've done is I've re-Gaelicized this story because, you know, these Croker and his lads, they said he spoke Irish, but his buddy said he didn't have a word of Irish, but they slummed it among the poor. This was the 1820s, 1830s. The country was heading for disaster, but these people, they had this kind of Arcadian view of the beautiful peasants picking the potatoes, an Arcadian view of Ireland. But anyway, out of sheer stubbornness, I re-Gaelicized the folktale.
And Fearishke, which is, I suppose, the short title of the opera, True Water, or the Water of Truth, is what we're looking at there. I think you're not just talking about the world of myth here. You're talking about contemporary society and pure water as well, aren't you?
Yeah. So, like, you think it could be just a throwaway, little silly little folktale, ladies and gentlemen, but actually it's an incredibly deep and powerful myth. Because, like, when I was writing this, when the king closes the well in the story and stops the water to the plain people of Ireland, of the loch, hundreds of thousands of people marched on the streets of Cork against the water charges. Yeah, and then when I was finishing, when I came to Act 3, you know, when the Princess Fearishke, she's warning everybody that they're going to be drowned. She can see the future. She's a visionary poet. That's Greta Thunberg. Pure Greta Thunberg, Fearishke, my princess. Mm. So myth is something that never happened, but always is.
I love that statement. Myth is something that never happened, but always is. And there's a lyric within the song that you just sang for us as well, which is talking about stepping outside of time. Is that part of what the whole idea behind the folk opera is? That you're not really, yes, you're using this myth, but you're talking as much about the present and the future as you are about the past.
Absolutely. Like, it's like this mythology is not something that happened long ago, even though it's told like that. It's actually real life truths. So, sorry, what was your question again, Sean?
I'm just saying, is that part of what you're doing, that you're not saying, oh, here's a story from the past, this is about the present and
absolutely.
The future.
And it's about the present and the future, and water rights. Water rights is going to be huge. Also, access to water. Also, themes like enclosure, you know, closing the well, sharing, looking after the poor in society, all those things.
All of those things are important with it. And I do have a few more questions, but let me bring in Alan Gilson at this point, which, of course, people from this part of the world will well know who Alan is, documentary maker, theatre director, playwright, and delighted that you're with us this evening. Thinking about the feature documentaries that you made, Alan, Meetings with Ivor, which I think we spoke about, in fact.
Yeah,
Ghosts
indeed.
Of Bagatonia,
yeah.
Days of Trees.
Yeah.
Phenomenal documentary quite recently about a buried story in the life of Tomás Hardiman, who's a man that I have worked with and you worked with several times as well. You're also the producer of the Shaking Bog Festival here, very close to Wicklow.
Well, not strictly speaking, no. I'm from up the road in the Glencree Valley, but it's my wife, Catherine Noons, is the director. I'm her humble assistant.
Oh, right. We better get that, dedication right.
But yeah, it happened last weekend. It's an extraordinary festival called the Shaking Bog, which is really at the confluence of art and nature, which I think is very true to Wicklow, as elsewhere. But, you know, truly magical weekend last weekend, you know, that we're kind of reeling with excitement and adrenaline since. And in a way, it's the perfect thing for Wicklow, you know, because Wicklow's such a strange county, you know. We suffer and benefit from our proximity to Dublin, as everybody here knows. But I always feel when you cross the border, even on something as mundane as the Dart, it's like a magnetic force field, you know, because there is an extraordinary mystery and magic about Wicklow, you know. And I think that, like John was alluding to, is embedded in the landscape.
Yeah, I was going to say, because if you think of particularly Northwood, you think of hills really quickly. You go a mile beyond Dundrum and you're up. If you're cycling, you're cycling up the hill. That's what you're doing.
Yeah.
How much... You're not... I noticed you did say we.
Yeah.
You're not originally a Wicklow man, but clearly if you're prepared to use we now, you are fully and fully fledged Wicklow man.
Well, I'm trying to come to terms with it, yeah. I mean, I realise in the Glencree Valley, you know, you have to be there a couple of centuries before you can really claim it. But, you know, I grew up in Raglan Road in the central Dublin, which is iconic in a different way, but have lived most of my adult life, as I think a lot of artists, in Wicklow. I don't know why, really. I was just drawn to the magic of the landscape. And there's a freedom here. Wicklow is a kind of renegade county. You know, it's a kind of outlaw place. You know, even if you go back to 1798 and the United Irishmen who hid out in the mountains. And it's still got that quality. You know, there's a kind of liberation in it and a kind of madness, which is a real joy. I always, as I drive out up the hill from Enniskerry and across the ridge and I see the mountains and the often, you know, if you drive out late at night, there'll be a stag deer standing in the middle of the road saying, "You're in the wrong place, sonny." But but there really is something magic about it. And, you know, and I think it's suffered because of, as I say, its proximity to Dublin. But I think gradually, you know, and I think the Shaking Bog Festival is part of Wicklow regaining its own identity, regaining its, without losing the kind of outlaw spirit.
Yeah.
But I think certainly the Shaking Bog, and there's a wonderful West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival run by Fiacra Garvey, and I kind of feel there's a little, and I'm not just saying it because we're here in the Mermaid, but there is a kind of resurgence. You know, artists have always kind of hid out here. You know, of course, you've Heaney and the Glanmore Sonnets and Patrick Scott and Sebastian Barry in West Wicklow. But there is a thing that kind of, we're finally articulating what Wicklow is in of itself.
How do you think that has fed in specifically to your work?
I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, I've always been drawn here, but I think it's something in the kind of, increasingly I've become interested in history and landscape. You know, maybe it takes a while to realise the feeling. You know, I think for many years, as many people in Wicklow, some of the people here, you know, there's a tendency to wake up in the morning, you're in the car and you're out of here.
Yeah.
But I think particularly, I mean, it's a gradual thing, but I think definitely during lockdown, and indeed, you know, I had an illness which kept me at home for 9 months. And I think both those experiences really helped me to meditate on the place I live in, you know. And I was a great man for reading about nature and talking about it. But, you know, to actually walk out and feel the landscape and feel the past and the folklore that John so beautifully articulated, you know. And I think increasingly, not just in Wicklow, but everywhere, we're connecting to that.
I was just going to say, that is precisely what you've done. You've been doing this for a long time in a lot of your work, John, but it strikes me that this new folk opera really delves into it. I mean, you have steeped yourself in the mythology of this loch and used that as a way to tell a story.
Yes, well, I think that Ireland is a magical country, and I think that if you go down anywhere in Ireland, you can find layers and layers and layers. You can go into the Irish language, you can go into nature, you can go into mythology. I mean, there's a guy working in this theatre who gave me a story of Bray Chulainn and the battle that happened here and how it was called the Bloody Something. You know, he gave me the whole lowdown, and it's fascinating stuff. So I see it as a big board game, and you can go down at various points, and it's full of one. We're sitting on a crock of gold, lads.
Yeah.
War was only last Friday night, I think.
Exactly. You were talking about the renegade county, and of course the rebel county, you know, is what we talk about when we talk about Cork. One of the other things, I think, John, it's not that this is a buried story in your opera, but unearthing a story is part of what you're dealing with in this, and people, warnings being listened to.
Absolutely. And as I say, like, this thing grew and grew for me. And then it was a friend of mine, actually, Gerdy O'Leary, who first said the word opera in relation to the loch. And I said, oh, my God, there's an opera in the loch. And I went to Gordy and I said, are you going to write it? He said, no. And so I said, oh my God, I could do this. You know, I'm trained for this. It's like a place where a lot of different streams come together. I find this in songwriting quite a bit. If we're at a place where things join, like the Loch, there's seven streams flow into the Loch. So in this, like, you've got folklore, you've got history, you've got tunes, you've got music, you've got the Irish language, loads of stuff comes together, and they're really rich places.
Yeah, and that idea of the buried story, I think for you, Alan, it's kind of more specific. Talk to me a little bit, because people may or may not have seen The Days of Trees, which is this story of Tomás Hardiman, who worked in the Abbey for years. I knew him when he was there. And this story I knew nothing about, and I think you knew nothing about for a long, long time.
Absolutely. I mean, like yourself, I met Tomás in the Abbey, and he was, you know, he was the playboy of the Western world. He was the guy you went out to.
Oh, he was a great crack, yeah.
And over the years, you know, very serious story of abuse emerged, and the film is about that. And you know, it's called, you know, we shot it all in Glenstall Abbey in Limerick, surrounded by, again, landscape and trees. And The Days of Trees kind of emerged as a title out of nowhere, really, from a poem Tomás wrote. But, you know, again, sometimes, you know, nature is beautiful, but it's also, I'd be aware around us that, you know, it's also a place of tragedy. It's a place where people go in despair. And it's also a place where people go looking for answers. But to come back to The Days of Trees, you know, Tomás wanted to face this terrible abuse he had as a young boy. But wants to face it in a more, not with a sense of retribution. You know, I mean, we've heard these horrific stories in recent weeks and recent years. And Tomás, I suppose, wants to approach it in a different way. He wasn't looking for vengeance. He just wanted to connect with who he was and find healing, not through compensation or the legal process, which he thought would be as another form of entrapment. You know, a lot of people who've suffered abuse end up in a legal process for 10 years where they're accused again and again. And I suppose he was trying to find a different way, though respecting those who...
One of the things that really struck me is that there's a point quite early on in the film where Tomás cries. And he cries about his happy childhood.
Yeah.
The pure joy of that happy memory brings tears to his eyes. And it's quite an extraordinary moment, because when he's telling us the darkest detail later on, he tells it quite matter-of-factly. Whereas it's the happiness that brings the tears.
Absolutely. And the loss of his wonderful brother. I mean, you know, even though it's a hugely dark and moving story, you know, obviously, as you understand, you have to, you know, laugh too. And I can remember when we started the interview and I talked to him over a week and I thought, well, I'll ask him the basics. We'll ease into it and talk about his family. And Tomás starts to cry. I mean, this is something I've said to Tomás many times. And I was thinking, oh, Jesus, we'll never get through the week. Like, if he's crying now.
Where are we going to be like,
But somehow that was cathartic. And it was very interesting as he told this very delicate story, personal, intimate story. He sort of gathered strength. That's what I liked. He gathered strength. And I think he feels that now, having made the film.
And I guess given events of recent weeks and the call for statutory investigations, the telling of the story is hugely important.
Huge, huge. And I do think, you know, without verging into the political, like, you know, I think the institutional church, and I stress institutional, has been extraordinarily bad in dealing with this thing. You know, this is a faith that talks about sin and forgiveness. And I never hear anybody in the church saying, I'm sorry.
To move off that onto looking forward to projects to come, you're involved with John Banville. And is this around the Book of Evidence? What state of play is that at?
Well, it's, you know, many, many years ago, I adapted the Book of Evidence for the stage, which was, you know, a wonderful experience. Declan Conlon playing Freddie Montgomery. And we have talked ad infinitum, probably, John will feel, about making a film of the Book of Evidence. So at the moment, with the O'Sullivan Productions here in Bray, from the great dynasty of Morgan O'Sullivan, we're in the process of casting a film of the Book of Evidence. So I'm always superstitious about, you know, saying anything about things that might happen, because I could be with you here next year.
Talking that we're still working on it. Yeah, and, or, but there is an opera. Working. There is an opera definitely happening in Kilkenny.
There is an opera, wonderful opera, based on a libretto by Paul Muldoon called Custom of the Coast, and a fantastic score by an Indian American, as opposed to an American Indian, a young, brilliant composer called Kamala Shankaram. And we will premiere that at the Kilkenny Art Festival next summer.
In August of next year. And we didn't get a chance to talk about Ghost of Bagotonia, which is your documentary film in and around Bagotonia, being that area in and around Bagot Street. And we should say, for those who want to find out more about that, that Ghost of Bagotonia will be screened tomorrow afternoon at 2 o'clock. This is as part of the Bagotonia Festival in Lansdowne Hotel on Pembroke Road. Bagotoniafestival.com. We'll give you the details there. And John, you are heading out around the over the coming months. You will be touring across Ireland and the UK, performing songs from Fear Iscaigh, as well as old favourites dates, available on your website, which is johnspillane.ie. And very soon, I hope you'll be coming in to tell me about the stage production of Fear Iscaigh. Alan Gilson and John Spillane. And we'll be back with more from the Mermaid Arts Centre after this break. And welcome back to Arena on Culture Night, live from the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray. 6 years on from her first solo record, singer-songwriter Susan O'Neill has released a follow-up album called Now in a Minute. I'm delighted to be joined by Susan this evening here on the stage of the Mermaid Arts Centre, along with Killian Brown on keyboards, going to perform songs from the new album, starting with Tijuana.
Couldn't save you. matter how we tried, we had to say goodbye.
Susan O'Neill with a song called Tijuana. She was accompanied there by Killian Brown on keyboards, and that song from Susan's new album Now in a Minute. And yes, for those at home, she was playing three trumpets, two guitars and singing all at the same time. Very clever use of trumpet and pedal and guitar. How confusing is all of that? Or does it just become like... Because obviously what you do is you play a little bit on the trumpet, record it with the pedal, and then you harmonise with yourself on the trumpet and sing with yourself on the trumpet.
Yes, it's a terrible affliction called no friends.
You're a multi-instrumentalist, so why wouldn't you put all of the instruments, or as many of them as you can, on the...
Boredom does a lot.
This album, I think, Susan, grew to a large extent, or was certainly written to a large extent during your time touring around America.
Yeah, a lot of songs came out on the road because you'd be sitting in the car for a long time and just looking out the window. And I don't know if anyone else is like me and just imagining all the time a little bit away with the ferry. So I'm always just looking at that house and thinking, who lives in there?
And just letting the imagination run riot.
And sometimes.
And was this in Tijuana? Were you in Tijuana?
Didn't make it down that far.
Only in a song.
To go. Yeah, exactly. But it was kind of this fictitious story and it was... In that storyline of the two lovers, and one of them was just terribly debaucherous and the other one wasn't.
That's very pitiful. Yeah. There you go. Which is, you have the two within yourself in terms of your travelling. You love to travel around the world for your performances, but there's nothing like getting home to Clare.
There isn't.
You're very faithful to Clare.
I'm a banner lady at heart. I love Ireland in general, though. Come on, it's gorgeous.
And how would you say that the landscape of Clare and the feeling of Clare makes its way into your music, I would guess, no matter where you are and no matter where you're writing?
I think that it's... someone said to me years ago, she said, it was a very interesting point, she said, I think the people of Clare are cracked like the rocks. And I really like that. You know, there's a lot of space, though. You know, you have a lot going on. It's teeming with life, but you sometimes have to just look a little bit deeper. And it's anything with sideways rain is going to add persistence. And you know, you're gonna really know how to just seize the moment when you get 5 minutes of the summer.
When the time comes. The second song that you're going to perform for us, by the way, I should say that the album has been launched today, this very moment, yeah, in fact, is kind of launching today, the album. Yeah.
Thank you.
The second song that you're going to perform for us, now, I've been at a lot of sound checks. I've never been inspired to write anything during a sound check other than I'm bored text. You wrote a song around a sound check. Is that true?
Well, when you're doing sound checks every day, but yeah, this song kind of came out in a big flurry, I guess. I was somewhere in Canada. I think it was in Canso, where I was playing in an ice hockey rink. Actually, it was very unusual. It smelled like dogs, though, because it was raining and all the dogs came inside. But I didn't mind that. I actually love dogs. So that has nothing to do with the song.
No.
Sorry. The melody came to my head and I recorded it and I found it later. And I actually sent it to Mick Fannery,
who helped a lot with the album, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
And of course, you'd been involved in the big collaboration. That was what had you traveling around America with him.
Yes. Yeah. And some solo shows, some with Mick. And then I did a lot of co-writes with Lorcan and Killian Byrne and Killian Brown here. So the whole album has actually come together with a lot of hearts and heads. Well, which is, yeah, fun.
Second song is called Everyone's Blind.
Yes, so, and I should also say that we're taking it around to record stores around Ireland over the next couple of days.
Oh, right. So people look out in the local record store for that. And as you're going over, I'll give them some detail of the headline tour in support of the new album now in a minute this autumn. It starts in Dolan's in Limerick. Several venues then around the country throughout October. Connolly's in Leppai and AC in Killarney, the Ocean Dove in Galway, Set Theatre in Kilkenny, and that's only mentioned in a few. And then in November, heads off to London and Europe, where Susan will presumably write a few more songs during sound checks. I hope as beautiful as this. Everyone's Blind.
Cold road, beach side. White strand, no concept of time. There's no saving for better days, no. You cannot bargain for a longer stay. Oh, but I'm old to make my own way. I will get to rest someday. Everyone's blind, everyone's blind. Thank God. I am waiting free.
Blind from Susan O'Neill from her new album Now in a Minute. SusanO'Neill.ie for full details of her tour. We'll be back with more from the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray after this break. And welcome back to Culture Night on Arena, live from the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray. I didn't even get a chance to say County Wicklow. There you go. Delighted to be joined now by visual artist Harold Offey, whose exhibition Leisure Seekers opens in 5.5 minutes' time. Well, 4.5 minutes' time. No, I can't work out the maths. In about of a quarter of an hour in the foyer outside here. I had a look at it just before we came to air, and you kindly brought me around it. Harold, delighted to have you with us on the programme. You spent time in Brighton, and now you've made this exhibition about Bray. How did you come to be making an exhibition about Bray in the first place?
Well, firstly, it's great to be here, and what an amazing show. So how do I come to be? It's really down to Anne Molly, who's the curator here, Mermaid Arts Centre, who invited me to develop this project. And she's instigated this season of commissioning artists to respond to Bray as a seaside town, particularly the relationship to kind of leisure. Mm. And as you have a connection to Brighton, I went to art school in Brighton. And I've made previous projects about seaside towns as well, Bournemouth. So, yeah, there's this kind of connection. And for me, just because I'd never been here before, and the project has emerged from several visits, really looking into the history and getting to know some of the local people.
And basically what you've given us upstairs at the exhibition is there's one huge, big central piece, which is an installation. And I asked you when I looked at the way this, it kind of moves along the top, and I said, what was your model for that kind of landscape or that float along the top of the installation? And it was?
It's Brayhead.
Brayhead, where else would it be? And on that, then, you have these almost postcard-size snapshot pictures of various buildings and places around Bray. What sort of things were you looking at in the snapshots that you took?
Well, those images have sort of come from the different walks that I took. So I made like 3 or 4 visits to Bray in different seasons. Mm. And a recurring thing was just to kind of walk around the town, you know, really embody that thing of being a tourist, being a visitor. And I'm interested in places that are designed to welcome people and to host people. So those photographs are just snapshots, observations of the landscape, but also like I became really obsessed with like people's front gardens and plants and exotic plants that, you know.
And also looking at the buildings that you've taken pictures of, there's one quite large picture as well that's part of the exhibition. There's a few big large or large pictures along the wall is of the Turkish baths here in Bray. So you're looking at that kind of certainly colonial history in terms of architecture.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for me, looking at the kind of history of Bray as a kind of seaside town and a resort and its origins, you know, within the kind of colonial period and really thinking about these kind of rich kind of villas and big houses that were built for, I guess, the kind of Anglo-Irish elite. But, you know, and this Turkish bath, which was kind of like this phenomena that I think was across Ireland of these Turkish baths springing up all over and having one in Bray, but also it as a failure and a folly. So, like, you know, the idea of having this kind of sort of luxury spa that no one was really interested
in.
So for me, that becomes quite emblematic about the relationship of who has access to leisure.
Yeah, and the other thing you have in the side room off then is a number of small sculptures are made from plastic materials, bottles and plastic paper, made by families in Bray who came in and did a number of workshops for you. If you're really careful how you answer this question, is Brighton the Bray of England? Or is Bray the Brighton of Ireland?
I think there's a really synergy. I mean, there's
some
there's some very, you know, obviously there's some obvious parallels, but there are also differences, obviously. And I'm sort of interested in those kind of connections, you know, they kind of, you know, the idea of the kind of seaside resort as a kind of fantasy space is what holds it. But, you know, there's a different dynamic here, and it's interesting to think about the kind of narrative and the development, particularly what's going on at the moment.
I very briefly want to mention the Bray, is it the Bray Swimmers? What's the correct title for the group?
Bray Beach Bathers.
Bray Beach Bathers. There's a bundle of them in tonight, including a man who's interviewed in the video, and his name is?
Les Scanlon, who's in the front here, who was the started really the group, the Bray Beach Bathers, who are just an extraordinary group of people who meet on the seafront and swim together.
As you did this morning.
I did this morning, yeah.
And you are part of the video installation swimming as well. Listen, that is a very interesting exhibition to look at, and thanks for sharing your thoughts with us on it. Harold Offrey.
Thank you.
Now, the Leisure Seekers will be opening at 8 p.m, as I said, here in the Mermaid Arts Centre. It was commissioned by the Mermaid Arts Centre 2024 Leisure Visual Arts Programme. Born Ronan Keely, Junior Brothers' debut album, Pull the Right Rope, earned a Choice Music Prize nomination for Irish Album of the Year. Similarly lauded second album, The Great Irish Famine, claimed another Album of the Year nomination at the RTÉ Folk Music Awards. He's working on his third album at the moment. He's live on Arena this evening. This is a song called Take Guilt.
I'm able to get hurt now and then be safe and sound. And here am I singing from a cozy land. The men who stand in my skin have the upper hand. Take a look at my face. Take a look at the glad for being born over here. But here he is, and why not her and them as well? The traveller, the immigrant, how have I never felt? How they look at my face, how they look at the build up underground. I'm able to get hurt now and then be safe and sound. And here am I singing from a cozy land. The men who stand in my skin have the upper hand.
Say where you are, actually, Junior. Junior, say where you are right there, because I'm going to just briefly chat to you about that song, which is so powerful, Take Guilt. What was the inspiration? What were you singing about there? It's an extraordinary statement that you're making, both emotionally and socially.
Thanks very much. I don't know, it's just a bit of catharsis, I suppose, and just understanding... I suppose privilege a little bit, and then coming face to face with that, and how do you deal with that coming from a place of privilege and the frustration that comes with that. So it's a catharsis with that at its source.
The men who stand in my place have the upper hand.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking at the white-faced man and the upper hand that has been there throughout history.
I suppose, yeah, it's just kind of the frustration of reading what's going on, the horrors around the world, feeling so close to it while you're reading it, and then just closing the newspaper.
Tell me that there is a third album on the way, because if that's the beginning of the set of songs for the third album, I want to hear the rest of them.
Well, thank you very much. The answer is yes, there's a third album on the way, Sean, yeah.
And when might we get it?
It'll be next year anyway, kind of after the summer.
Well, John Spud Murphy, who's works a lot with Lancome, is involved with you on this one, as he has been, I think, on previous work as well. But this is a whole new way for you. You are, however, to finish up, going to go back to an old song for us, which feeds into a little bit what we were talking about earlier on in Landscape, doesn't it? The men who eat ring forts, the people who destroy the past.
Yeah. I got it was the name of a book by Sinead Mercier. Great book. Eddie Linehan's contributes to it as well. Yeah. He's a big hero of mine. And it was released last year, that single, and then Take Guilt was just released on Wednesday.
Okay.
And for Take Guilt, there's a single launch on October 19th that just sold out. So we're actually going to announce a headliner in the Button Factory for March 21st.
Great. Well, listen, you can send us details of that when they come in. Get yourself ready for the second song. We'll hear Junior Brother with that in a minute. But first of all, I want to thank Judy Kelleher, Owen Fagan, and all the team at the Mermaid Arts Centre here in Bray. Thanks also to the Arts Council, which is supporting all of RTE's Culture Night events this evening. Our guests this evening who give us such wonderful music and thoughts as well. And the wonderful audience here in the Mermaid Arts Centre in Bray. On sound for RTE, Damien Chanel and Liam Mullen, James Feeney back at bass, my arena colleagues here in Bray, where Ollie Hamilton, Pauline McNamara and Amandine Paso-Devine. Tonight's show was researched by Leah Murphy and produced by Sinead Egan. I'll be back with you back at bass Monday night at 7 on RTE Radio 1. But for now, this is Junior Brother with The Men Who Eat Ring Forts.
Out quick, this is it, and I can't take it back, because modern life doesn't ask questions. Think quick, this is it, and you won't give it back, because modern life doesn't ask questions. I'm in the middle of a hole to be buried by the men who eat ring forts. Come inside the ring forts.